Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello again, my wonderful, wonderful audience. I have a charming, wise, insightful break for you today with Michael Fontaine, a dear friend of me and Ginger. He's actually local, and he's a professor, and his specialty is classics. And today is going to be a different day than I've ever had on my show, in that I sent Michael a paper of mine. It's actually my most recent published paper. I have another one coming out soon on vaccines. But this is my most recent published paper on helplessness and love, and what I think is the greatest dread of all, feeling not worthy of love. So Michael has a copy of the paper. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Peter. Welcome back. Or I should say welcome back to you. I feel like I'm going to be the host today, but thank you for having me back. This is the paper here. I'll hold it up so people can see.
Yeah, there. Oh, that's good. People can see it. Psychological helplessness and feeling undeserving of love. Windows into suffering and healing. And Jeannie Stolzer is my co-author. I invited her in to have her add to the section on child rearing and nursing and things like that. Thank you. You can put it down now. You're looking terrific today.
Well, I knew I was going to see you, Peter, so I had to, you know, put on a shirt with buttons. No, I'm really happy to see you. I always love talking to you. And I'm excited to talk to you about this paper you sent me the other day, in part because, and I should tell the audience right away that if you folks want to read the paper, it's as easy to read as any, it's easier to read than almost any academic paper that I have encountered in many years. It's just written in plain English. You don't need any special expertise to read this thing. But you know, when you sent it to me the other day, Peter, I had asked you about grief and coping mechanisms for grief, which is what I'm working on. And you sent me this thing, and it just took my breath away to read it, and not in a good way.
Wow.
What I mean by that is this concept you talk about of feeling unworthy of love, not feeling just unloved. That's horrible enough. But the concept that if I read the paper correctly, right, this idea that people convince themselves that they are unworthy of love. And I have to say, I almost started crying reading the paper. I sent it to a whole bunch of people. One person wrote back and said, is this about me? I said, no, it's not about anything anybody's ever done. But I said, it's this very simple and profound insight. And you're using a word that I haven't heard used in any official capacity on university campuses ever. And the word is love, right? I mean, we don't use this word. You might hear it in a religious gathering, and you might hear it in a private setting. I think if I were to begin giving discourses on love in the college classroom, people would probably file complaints. They'd say, this is really strange. I mean, who does this person think he is?
Wow.
Does that sound about right to you, or is it different from your point of view?
Well, in psychiatry, we never use the word. I've not seen much in psychology. But I think special paper. But the whole culture is afraid of talking about love. But I'm just awed by, I agree with you. Yes, I didn't know you might get called up on morals charges. But I can imagine that right now. People are interested in sex. What's your gender? What's your sex? And things like that. And they don't stop to think, well, it's really about love, isn't it? Whatever your gender orientation is and so on, isn't it about love? And I think the answer is no, it's political or something. So, I think we're getting even more distortions of love lately. And it is an ignored subject. There are good books written about it over the years, but it's basically an ignored subject. And I've not seen anybody hone in on the feeling of being unworthy of love. And I think it's just so painful. But I think it's what crushes us at the worst of our times.
Yeah, to feel that way, and you begin in infancy here, right? I mean, the idea, and it's credible, although I'm not, as you know, any kind of clinician or anything, the children grow up feeling not just unloved, which is bad, it's awful, but unworthy of love. And then you trace this out and how it manifests, that feeling carries through into adulthood and leads to some of the self-destructive behaviors that we often have different names for, right? I thought one of the profound insights, I marked up the whole paper here, but I have highlights everywhere. But, you know, you talk in one case about the woman who grows up and looks for alcoholic men as a romantic partner, or the person who seeks out a mentor that does nothing but abuse the person. And I thought, I mean, are these obvious insights in psychiatry, psychology, clinical stuff today? Or is that, I mean, to me, this is eye-opening stuff, that the reason people are doing that is they're seeking the love now that they're trying to prove that they are worthy of love.
Exactly. They're going to, I don't know how much you'll find this stuff in psychology anymore. I don't think the academic community certainly is into insight anymore, and especially into things like love. But it's not out of any particular school that I came to the conclusion. And I came to the conclusion from looking at myself and my clients and my friends and life that it's that unworthiness. Now, I think Christianity, though, probably tries to address it pretty directly at its best, which is and Judaism, the idea that we're all God's children and we all have worth, and Christianity with its concepts of that Jesus loves us unequivocally. So I think that religion tries to deal with it. Certainly the Western religions have tried to deal with this, sometimes very directly.
So maybe I could comment a little bit on that, because, you know, as I think I mentioned the other day, you sent me the paper at almost the perfect moment. You don't know this, but you did. Why? Because I just finished teaching a very difficult course. We did it all online. That's what made it difficult, right? On a course at Cornell called Introduction to Ancient Rome. And so what I'm trying to do is expose students to what daily life and morality and politics and philosophy were like before the rise of Christianity, right? So, and then what happened when the Roman Empire became Christianized. And so we did a fair amount this semester about ancient philosophy. And I have some of the books, I just pulled them out. But one of them, for example, just came out in a new translation. You're going to love the title, How to Keep
Your Cool. Oh, yes.
And
How to Keep Your Cool.
Yeah, this is it. And it's all about, self-control, not giving into anger and all that sort of thing. And so these are the Stoic techniques that seem to have, the Stoics were an ancient philosophical sect that more or less pioneered cognitive behavioral therapy. That is to say, practical techniques to overcome what your problem is. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff in there. But when this paper hit, I realized that in all the ancient philosophy I've read, they don't talk about love. And it really is with Jesus in Judea, right around the exact same time this was written, actually. Jesus was crucified in 33. I think his usual date, this book probably written about 15 years later, maybe 20, 25 years later. I got to pull out my dates, but it doesn't matter. But the idea, Jesus had this insight, this fundamental insight that what people want isn't sex, they want love, right? I mean, you look around the world, what do we have? We have brothels for people to go to for sex, but you don't see brothels for hugs. Can you imagine? Can you imagine, like, a hug is what most people, everybody needs a hug, right? Can you imagine? But it sounds silly. I mean, you laugh even at the concept. I do. I laugh. It says,
and no, so, I love it. It's so interesting.
So Jesus had the twin insight, I think, first, right? This unconditional love. This is what you're talking about. Everybody is worthy of love. And it comes out of Judaism very clearly, as you say. Everyone is God's child. These are alien notions in the Greek and Roman world. The people who were genetically similar to a lot of us, you know, watching the show or listening. So we can take the genetic thing out of the equation and see how people coped with these problems back then. And then Jesus' second fundamental insight was the idea of forgiveness. And there's not a lot of evidence for forgiveness prior to Jesus spreading this concept around. Now, obviously, within small context, people forgave, people all around the world have always forgiven each other in small things. But he went on to say, you have to always forgive, always, 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 always. It's a pretty hard thing to do. But he understood that, at least in my reading of this, everybody screws up. Some of us screw up pretty badly sometimes. I'm sure we all have regrets, right? We all have. But the idea that no matter what you've done, someone will still love you is a profound idea. And at the moment, it's contained entirely within religious contexts. And what's exciting about your paper, I think, Peter, is you say we need to take that and bring it out of religion. Not that it has to leave religion, but it needs to be brought into these other contexts of distress. That is why I'm so excited about your paper. I think it's really exciting.
It was interesting. I didn't know what response I would get. I sent it to only one place, the Humanistic Psychologist Journal, which is the journal of the American Psychological Association's Division on Humanistic Psychology. And I've actually never had such a response to a paper. They loved it. Both of the critics that they sent it to review, neither of whom I think I knew, said they had nothing that it would require to be changed in the paper. One of them said, if you want to, you could add so-and-so to it. They made it like a special paper at the beginning of the issue. And my life is so filled with the conflict and strife issues. I've always put myself in these cutting edge, what I think needs to be done issues. There's not a lot of love in there, but there's quite a bit among many of the doctors now working to try to properly treat COVID-19. And there is a lot of affection and a lot of goodwill. But it was very stunning to me, that response. This paper, folks, is on my website. If you search I will put it up in a way that you can easily find it on the website. What's the opening? Yeah, I think if you search psychological helplessness, you'll be able to get it. But I'm going to set it up so that you can find it. It just came out last year. So tell us more about classics and where all this fits in, because it's your thinking that you're just, of course, so different from mine in that I don't know anything about the classics, or very little. I mean, you sent me Cicero's book, and which you happen to have there by chance today, I guess. And I read that on duties a few times. How do you connect this to on duties, to the ancient, in this case, Roman philosophers?
So I love the question, and you get at a problem that I feel like I spent my career trying to fix, and that's that the past is a foreign country to so many of us, right? Mm-hmm. Someone doesn't tell you in school, ideally, or in the family, although that's rare, you'll never know this stuff. And if you grow up in sort of the new world, as we used to call it, you really have no idea of how deep history goes. I mean, Americans go to see the city of Rome and they see the Pantheon, the most beautiful building, second most beautiful building in town. It's 2,000 years old and the thing is made out of cement and it's a gigantic dome. And you see American tourists, either jaws are hitting the floor, they say, I could speak 2,000 years old. And you say, well, there's a lot we don't know. We need to cover that. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this book. It was translated by, this copy was translated by an extremely gifted translator who's a trial attorney in Kansas, not an academic. But an extraordinary gift for languages, for insight, human experience. And this book that he translated, On Duties, is by Cicero. So Cicero, just to back up, was basically the president of ancient Rome. Born 106 BCE, he was assassinated in 43 BCE. What is this book? This book he wrote to his son after he had retired from politics. His son, Marcus Jr., was about 19 years old. He was a college student in Athens, Greece, studying philosophy, and apparently he wasn't getting his life in order. So his father said, son, I'm going to basically tell you how to make the right decisions, how to conduct your life so that you grow up and you have a fulfilled life. you'll be happy to, and so on. And, you know, Peter, if I could get a jeweler to gild the pages of this thing, I would. The wisdom of this book is so profound. It was the second book ever printed in Europe. The first book printed was the Bible. Yeah. This is the second book. And it has endless connections. One of the most famous quotes in here, Cicero says, he attributes it to Plato, but he's probably wrong. He says, we human beings are not born for ourselves alone. Mm-hmm. And this, just to reflect on that for a second, right? I mean, what does that mean? We're not born and raised for ourselves alone. You know, I think so many of us sitting at home during COVID right now, we feel alone. We feel like we're only in this for ourselves. There's all kinds of people on the internet that will tempt you to selfishness and so on. And Cicero, he rejects all that. He says, that's wrong. You know, we are born into a society. He makes some of the connections you make. He says, you know, we have parents. And what does that mean? We have an obligation to other people. We have duties to other people. So even if you don't feel like getting off the sofa and doing something, tough luck. You need to if you want to have a happy life. Don't just sit there and stew quietly. And so he begins at the very beginning. He actually touches on a point where you talk about primate research in the paper. Do you mind if I read this to you?
Yeah.
So this is right from the beginning. As you can see, I got a million little sticky notes off to the side. They're not all in the right place for today. But I have read this with classes 5 years in a row now. He talks about nature, right? He says, nature reconciles man, meaning man and woman, to discourse and social life by the power of reason. And nature generates in man an exceptional love for those produced as his offspring. Nature also impels him to want to be part of assemblies and meetings with others. But it goes on to say, this is different from animals, right? Between man and beast, there's a great difference. The beast is moved by sense. It accommodates itself only to what is in the present moment, distinguishing little between the present and the past. But man, because he partakes in reason, or we would say thinking, clear thought, and through this discerns consequences, sees the causes behind things, and is not ignorant of progress and antecedents. And so we're impelled by nature, it seems, to search out the truth. But he connects it immediately, this is on the first few pages, with love, right? Within the family, or at least within the parents, and so on. Does any of this sound familiar to some of the things you wrote in that paper?
Well, yes, very, very much so. I think that a lot of what I'm talking about, reasonable people have thought about one way or another for a long time. And I'm very aware that I'm not striving for originality. I'm striving to find a way to put what seems to me to be the essential wisdom of life into a language that people today can understand and that I can understand. I think we're so afraid of accepting our vulnerability to other people, how much we need them and love them or want to love them. And by the time most of us grow up, it's been kicked out of us. And I guess one of the things I'm always trying to encourage my audience, my friends, myself to do is to come back to loving and trusting love and to being friends with your friends and love your loved ones and get all the problems out of the way. But I think that if we looked at ourselves in our daily conflicts, 9 out of 10 times when there's an upset, our sense of being unlovable is being stirred up. And so, that's, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I agree other people have talked about love before, but I think it's the context in which you're bringing it in and the step you go after this. You say the feeling, the psychological helplessness, the sense of unworthy of love is what's causing, maybe not all, but certainly very many of the problems that we have different names for today. This is the final section, right? This won't be probably surprising to any of your listeners, but... you have ideas, for example, about the things that we call depression, the things that we call schizophrenia, the things that we call hallucinations and so on. And I don't know that this is completely original, maybe it is, but I mean, you're saying the feeling of being unworthy of love is, that is the sand, the grain of sand from which everything is starting to get wrapped up in. the ear.
You know, I don't think I realized how original the idea is until we were talking today. And I think it's part of why the readers at the journal, the Humanistic Psychologist, why they were so struck by it, didn't even want to bother criticizing or nitpicking with it, because there's some essential truth there. And certainly it hasn't been easy for me to get there to look at it.
It's just the context, again, that you say them in. Here, you're a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, trained in these techniques that are very different for assessing some of the problems.
Yes.
Not to put too obvious a point on it, but you know, I was struck recently. I'd like to give everyone, obviously, you know, totally anonymized, but an interaction with a student who was very distressed at some material in class. Okay, right. I mean, so material, you know, reading material in class can be stressful or distressing, disturbing, depending on what it is, offensive. I mean, Lord knows everybody gets offended at certain times, but in this particular case, it was almost an acute form of distress at the reading material, and was upset and sought help and was referred to a medical doctor for the help. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't need medical training in this case to say, well, I mean, maybe a doctor could help you, but is that the natural first port of call for something like this? You've heard this story before.
Well, this is what it's all about. That's right. I mean, this concept just, well, in many ways, like the concepts of Judaism and Christianity, it just overturns, you know, the entire system that's so superficial, that churns people, that brings all kinds of folks money and power and esteem, but never addresses this common aspect of humanity, where we begin to feel like we are essentially worthless, unworthy of love, essentially worthless. I think that you know, COVID-19 and the way it's been handled, and I haven't gone into the territory either, essentially is doing that to us. I mean, we're being treated as if we, each of us as an individual, has no inherent worth. That we're not essentially lovable, essentially of worth. It's all about numbers and manipulations of numbers. And behind it all, I mean, it's just this terrible thing of this global malignant phenomena we have now that I'm calling predatory globalism, which is, it's much more important for everybody, for the system to make a ton of money vaccinating people, or a ton of money getting new drugs, or a ton of power in your institute. And to do that, you actually keep making things worse for people. You don't allow them to have drugs at work. We have all these treatments at work, and I've got wonderful things on my YouTube about it. Doctors who know how to treat people for COVID-19 and they're not allowed to because it's outside the system. So and these are more loving people. You can see that they have put their love of their work and their patients ahead of what the government's telling them to do. Whereas most American docs have caved in. They're not treating people for COVID-19 until they're so sick they go to a hospital. They're not giving them the traditional drugs we have for viruses that we know work, and the traditional additives that we can give in the way of vitamins that help, and so on. And I think it's all related somehow.
Yeah, maybe if you don't mind, I think I'm going to disagree with you a bit on that. My reading, of course, is as I always say, I don't know anything about virology. But my reading as I look around is that we have deep, deep disagreements about what will do the most good. But everybody's trying to help other people, aren't we? I mean, the vaccine is here, I think. I mean, everybody's working like mad to try and create vaccines to save lives. And obviously, this is the horrific thing about this pandemic. I mean, whose life do you save? How do you do it? And so I would be more inclined to attribute a lot of this to incompetence than malice on anyone's part.
I think it's outright organized malice. I think it's as unapologetically malice as any other murderous empire kind of a thing. There's a, you know, bringing it back to these concepts. When people do not feel worthy of love, it leads them to have terrible motives. It leads them to be filled with hate or indifference, which is just where your hate's so intense you just can't bear it, or you become indifferent, or maybe you become indifferent and that leads to hate, but they're related, indifference and hate. And people begin to think about their own power, their own self-aggrandizement, their wealth. I don't think Genghis Khan was motivated by love and trying to do good. I don't think that the people who killed Jesus were motivated by good. I don't think the Romans, when they tried to stamp out Judea and the Jews, were motivated by good things or kind things. I don't even think they bothered to think so the way we do now. And I do believe that we're in the grip of a kind of a violent, predatory, take advantage of humanity place. And I think it's partly because there isn't any love out there. I think a lot of these people who are involved in this, I name names in my blogs. For some reason, I don't want to get into that today. And in my legal report that for one of the legal cases trying to stop the shutdowns, I think that the people get evil. I don't know how it starts exactly. I don't know how much of it starts in childhood. Because I've seen horribly abused people who are very good and try with all their hearts to do what's right. But you see some very abused people who don't do that. They go into a terrible place. So you and I have a different worldview, and it's interesting to share it. But I don't want mine to be discouraging. I think that we have always had to fight for what's good, and we've had to fight for liberty, and we've had to fight for our independence. And we need community strength to do that. These same people who are trying to make so much money off the vaccines, they do want a top-down government. They do not want democracy. They have written about this and how patriotism and democracy don't work with globalism, how globalism requires that people listen to what's good for them and so on and so forth. And many of them are very closely allied with China. The Bidens are very closely allied with China. They've taken a lot of money from them. I don't think there's any time. So I think it's a big issue. Should I edit that out?
Whatever you like, Peter, but I think I'm gonna register my disagreement with some of this. I really do see people doing, and maybe I'll just make one comment. I do see in my corner of the universe, or the way maybe I look at some of these same data, people trying to do good. And one thought that keeps coming to my mind is that public health is the negation of civil liberty.
Yes, it is.
It is the purest example of where civil liberty theory falls apart, or you can't have both.
None of these people have any concept of liberty. It's amazing. You can just read all of their stuff. Their concept is they know what's best. And how do we get people to agree? And we can terrorize them to do it. It's actually in their academic papers. We can frighten them into conformity.
Yeah, well, yes. Paternalistic threats, I think, are probably not the way to go. But you know, the opposite point of view would be, I suppose, that we can't protect ourselves from getting infected from other people. So if someone doesn't want to wear their mask, actually, you know what? I'm going to bring this back to Stoicism. We're going to exit the year 2020, because hopefully before long, some of us will all be gone. I'm going to tell you about a thought I had. This is from this book, How to Keep Your Cool. This is Seneca. This is the guy writing. He was a contemporary of St. Paul, you know, the guy from the Bible. And in fact, they have a slight connection because this author's brother shows up in the Bible. He's in the Acts of the Apostles in just one line. So there's a chance they knew each other, though it's not very likely.
That's amazing. Isn't that something? I didn't know that there were those kind of historical connections.
It's really something to see. Yeah, we just did this in my class, and I said at the line, and I said, this guy's brother, a guy named Gallio, was the sort of the governor of this little region that Paul went passing through. But anyway, so here's an idea that I was, in Stoic theory, I've been sort of kicking around. I thought I would write a little article, but I've decided not yet. Seneca is a Stoic, and in Stoic thought, the idea is you have to master your emotions. Any emotion you feel is you're just looking at things the wrong way. This is going to sound familiar a lot from psychotherapy. You lack insight, or you're overvaluing or undervaluing this or that. But in Stoic thought, emotions are contagious. Now, this, I think, is fascinating. I sort of pounded some thoughts out. I didn't get very far with it, but these are the thoughts I had. So I say, you know, as I was reading this with my class, I said, sometimes a metaphor or an analogy is useful in understanding an unfamiliar concern. But sometimes reversing the metaphor explains things that are so familiar that you never would have seen it that way. And so it's an old insight or an old idea that moods are contagious, right? Mm-hmm. You go to a party, somebody's a downer, next thing you know, the party's a bust. But the measures we're taking to counteract COVID has suddenly brought home the idea and set it into a new light. And what I'm talking about here are masks. And Seneca goes on, so what are we saying about masks right now? And I know you may disagree with this, Peter. I'm a mask wearer myself. I actually have a really nice one that was done. I got a painting that a friend of mine done. I printed it up and had it as a mask. But Seneca says, controlling anger is one of the most important things we human beings can do, right? Anger is destructive. It can whip entire people into wanting to go to war, do terrible things. So he says, we owe it to ourselves to control anger because we will make all kinds of horrible choices. But anger is contagious. And so even if it takes all your strength to stifle your anger for yourself and you fail, you will protect other people from getting infected with your anger and getting themselves. And that seems to be the principle of the masks right now. The mask won't protect me if I wear it from getting infected, but it might protect you or someone else. That is really something to see, this idea of emotional contagion. Is this familiar, unfamiliar? What do you think in psychiatry? Does that sound something?
Well, I don't think in psychiatry any more than I think in Arabic. I don't have that kind of thinking process. But it would be interesting for you to listen to some of the discussions that with the doctors that I've had on a show about masks and things like that, or some of my blogs and things about it. There's very little science to anything they're doing now. They have no precedents. They have no science. The science of masks is extremely weak and contradictory. And there's a lot of health risks to masks.
The last thing would be concerning, I suppose, if there's health risks.
But well, yeah, you're rebreathing your own breath. If you have a virus, you're going to rebreathe the virus. You're going to escalate it. It's there's a reason why God made us breathe we evolved that way, one or the other. But I think one of the most interesting things here, and I don't know how in the world we would deal with it in a on film, on a video like this, is the difference between the idea that people are good, essentially good, and then they make mistakes, or that the motivations of some people are actually quite different than they are for other people. And that the perpetrators of horrendous acts, the serial killers, the mass murderers, the dictators, I would say people who run drug companies and create vaccines out of the figments of their imagination. See, this is what I say. They have different motives. They're not actually sitting around connected to us. That they don't have, especially in these large institutions, that very quickly you get a disengagement from love. and feeling like you're unworthy of love, you pour into things other than loving attitudes toward people. And the larger the institutions, the more remote. The Stoic philosophy, I think, was very useful for dealing with horrible distress. McCain once said, the Washington Post, I've never been able to find it, that when he was imprisoned in North Vietnam, he was reading The Slave, Stoic.
I'll tell you about that. So it's not McCain, but it was the other one, Stockdale.
That makes more sense that I've made a mistake. Oh, thank you. So tell people about that.
This is fascinating. So Seneca is one of the main authors that we have for Stoic thinking, but even more relevant in this context, there's a handbook of Stoicism. It's readily available in translation. A handbook to Stoicism by a slave named Epictetus.
Yeah, and this is somebody, folks, just so you understand, that I read a lot when I was younger. I don't know how I got him, but yes.
Golden words. Epictetus was from the country that's Turkey today, and he moved to Rome, and he wrote this handbook on how to master your emotions, be a good Stoic, and so on. And he wrote this. He has some very difficult pronouncements. Maybe you agree, maybe you disagree, but he says, what he's getting at is he's saying the real you is on the inside, right? It's this quality that emerges from the blobs of DNA and flesh and bone and blood and all. But you're not reducible to, what's literally biological biomass type stuff. I think we all feel like we're our own person. And he says, so your enemies can kick you and hit you and do everything they can to destroy you. But the true sage, the person who truly understands philosophy, understands that those people can never hurt him or hurt her. Stoicism was taught to men and women alike in the ancient world. So it was popular with both men and women. Now, that's pretty tough.
One of the emperors.
That's right. And so what happened to Stockdale? Is it James Stockdale? I think that he was the most highly decorated member of the U.S. Navy. He was an aviator, Navy aviator. He was shot down over North Vietnam, and he had, before he deployed, had been getting a PhD in ancient philosophy. And he wrote a book called Courage Under Fire, and the subtitle is something to the effect of Testing the Doctrines of Epictetus in a North Vietnamese Prison Camp.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it's a tremendous, absolutely bracing piece of literature, an amazing classic. We read it in not this semester, but I've done it in the past. And what does he say? He says, well, I was thinking about this as I ejected from the airplane and I was going down. I thought, well, now is going to be the chance to test Epictetus. Can they really not hurt you? And then he goes on to say, let's get one thing out of the way. If people are breaking your legs with a pipe or so, they can absolutely hurt you. But then the book ends on this triumphal sort of feeling of insight. He says, what I realize is they can absolutely break your body and destroy you. But if you don't give in who you are, if you don't surrender, almost in a way, I'm thinking about your psychological helplessness kind of thing. If you remain unbowed, you remain true to yourself. That's what Epictetus and the Stoics were talking about.
Right.
And it sounds, just reading your paper, if you don't mind me just going on a bit more, I mean, it sounds like this is a lesson that we have got to find ways to make people truly get, right? I mean, we have a duty to make everyone else feel like they are worthy of love, right? So that they're not psychological helpless. That seems like the duty of us, all of us, who feel like we are worthy of love, to make sure that nobody else feels that way.
Yes, but I think, I'll just tell you what I think. I think it's a good philosophy for a beleaguered slave. Okay. I think it's a good philosophy for those moments when you're trapped in childhood in an abusive situation. It's a good philosophy to prepare yourself for, when you're parachuting down. But it's a very bad philosophy to get stuck in, because we want to have the freedom to create loving relationships. And those, according to the Stoics, are too dangerous. And I think a central theme in Stoicism, be interesting to see, because you have so much more knowledge about it, but I sure have read Epictetus, and I've read a few others around the corners of it, is that you reduce your passions, and in particular, passionate attachment to people. And this is what is happening under COVID-19, and I believe actually there is a sinister aspect to it. They want us to reduce our passionate attachments, just as Romeo and Juliet illustrate in their own way. Intense love is the enemy of oppression and of bigotry and of destruction and control and so on and so forth. And I want people not to go the way of Epictetus, except as a starting point. It's that poem about I'm the master, I'm the captain of my soul. You're the captain of your soul, maybe, but then you better have either God or love of human beings, maybe both in there, that gives you a connection. And right now they're trying to take away our connections. That's the mask. That's, I think, the major damn purpose of masks, because the science behind it's very weak. That we need to relate to each other, to love each other. We need to organize. We need to resist what's being done to us. And we need to connect and let ourselves care. It is very frightening to care a lot.
I want to some of this. Again, I'm going to leave aside the sort of the modern situation, because that's it's not my expertise. But what I'm thinking more about Cicero's book on duties.
Right.
Particular in the sense of what you're saying, Stoicism is not a good philosophy. It's the right philosophy when you're being shot, when you're ejected from an airplane into enemy territory.
Yeah, I really think so. It's a grounding when your back's to the wall.
Yeah,
that's not really a way of life.
That's really profound, and this is going to get into some of what you're getting at, right? So right now in Silicon Valley, Stoicism is huge. Are you aware of that?
No.
So this is in the New York Times just last year. I read an article.
It fits with, I think, that they have all unloving, self-involved human beings who are not thinking one bit about the long-term consequences for a lot of people in what they're doing. They're control freaks. That's where you go. If you go too much into I am the captain, you go to I am God, you go to indifference toward others. That's really helpful. I hope you'll send me something on Stoicism, and because it fits with my concept of these predators that we're looking at now. They have lost connectivity to us, to nation, to patriotism, to God. Their only connectivity is their mutual power serving.
Now you're sounding just like, that's why I wanted to bring it back to this book. He wrote it as an antidote to Stoicism for his son. And Cicero knew, because, you know, he was probably like you and me, that Stoicism is a very powerful drug for a 19-year-old guy, which is what his son was, right? I am the individual unit. I don't need anyone else. As you say, this rudyard spring type stuff. I'm the captain of my soul.
It's a bit like Ayn Rand, too, who contributed so much to me when I was young. I mean, in my 30s. I was pretty immature in my 30s. I am it. And you can be it too, and you can be it too, instead of, hey, we're made of each other.
Yeah, that's what Cicero
says. We need each other. Okay, go ahead.
We need these passionate attachments. We don't, it's what you're saying, we don't need this aloof, impassive, no one can hurt me, I'm this sort of guru that's beyond good and evil. And Cicero says, that's not the real world. You need to leave the seductive stuff aside. One thing that I hear you say about in these, predatory relationships sounds to me like a typical problem with leadership, right? I mean, anyone who leads a large organization soon finds that there's no friends in the inner leader circle, because everybody either wants your job for themselves or they want you out of the job. And so a bona fide friend is kind of hard to find.
Right.
And I wonder if we could think... I'm not sure that I've got great ideas, but how to make sure people don't wind up in a position where they feel like they can't trust anyone. I mean, I would imagine some of the same corporations that you target for, you know, you say these people are doing, these organizations, the leaders are doing the wrong thing. I wonder if they were like that before they got to the top, or to the same degree, or if that's a almost inevitable outcome of being at the top of a competitive organization.
Well, I think it's a quality required to get to the top. So you, if you have it to begin with, you probably have an advantage, and then you get it later. And if you're ambivalent about it, you have a miserable time. I remember very early when I started doing media, and I would have these really good local talk shows that would have conversations like this that were really interesting. And then as I got up in the media and I finally was on 2020 and 60 Minutes and all these others, I noticed a growing lack of understanding as I went up. So that literally, and I sound almost a cliche, was having more interesting conversations with the chauffeur in the car they sent for me in Bethesda to drive me down to D.C. than when I got to D.C. and got on the air with some famous person. And that when you have these powerful structures, they take the life out of you, especially the critical intelligence. You may have a great mechanical IQ, do well on a test, although I think that gets, even that is an impairment as you get higher up. You have to be thinking in a predatory way, unfortunately, I think, to get into these large corporations. And you describe very personally what it must be like for people who are there. And I don't have an answer to this. I think that looking at capitalism, for example, I mean, I think a lot of people right now are really, who are conservatives, are really off base. And I tend to be in that, I'm libertarian, sort of some conservative in there, because they think that somehow big business is really good, that it's free enterprise. No, it's not. None of those big businesses are free enterprise. They're all working through top-down government. They all get in with the Faucis and the bureaucrats and the heads of the CDC and the FDA and WHO, and they're all working through that. They're not working through, let's keep a clean field. They're working through, how do I get in charge? And I don't know what the answer is. I don't think human nature is compatible with it. I mean, we evolved as creatures in extended families. We lived literally and matured in an evolutionary way in extended families where we took care of each other. We were wary of strangers. We might welcome them or not. We might have rituals to get past them on a path if you met them. But basically, you had this loving structure, a supportive structure, I believe not idyllically loving, because that's not in human nature. We're too conflicted. And I don't have the answer to how in the world we can fix this. I think the founders of the country had the right idea. You have to have checks and balances, and the people have to be able not to rule like a wild democracy, but through a series of checks and balances. And the checks and balances now are on the agenda to be destroyed. So I think it's a real problem we're facing right now in the world. And we need to go back to some of the simple things about the Bill of Rights and protecting individual freedom and things like that. Wow. I don't think there's a simple solution. These big organizations, they are always taken over by ruthless people. Gandhi did not run an institution, Martin Luther, a big institution, profit-making. Gandhi didn't do it. Martin Luther King didn't do it. George Washington ran a plantation, and he did at least set his slaves free on his wife's death. So he knew it was wrong, and put his whole funds went in to take care of the slaves after his wife died. So, but once you're into these power positions, they corrupt. I don't know an easy solution other than individual freedom. It's the same one that the founders were struggling with. If only our young people knew about them.
It'd be interesting to take some of these ideas, right, about freedom and see what are the obligations that we impose on people with maximal freedom. And that's where, you know, again, I keep bringing it back to Cicero as I think about some of the principles. This was a guy who became a president of ancient Rome himself, right? And he says he had the height of all power. I mean, the guy was, he controlled certainly the largest army, let me think, probably the largest army in the world at the time, and all kinds of unlimited political power and everything. But he felt it incumbent upon himself to talk about our obligations to others, not just I can do what I want.
Yes.
What do we owe other people? Obviously, everybody who doesn't get to enjoy the things that we get to enjoy. You meant the comment about extended families. That's something that is important, but it's impossible to see until you go to another country, right? It is. I mean, the American ideal of a very small nuclear family, very small, is increasingly popular around the world, but it wasn't so long ago, right, that nobody lived like that. Everybody had aunts and uncles and grandmothers and kids everywhere, and it's clear that when people can get away from the overcrowded house, they do want to get away from that. But I wonder if we're getting too far away from some of that. And the internet makes it all worse, and the social media makes it worse. Now, I don't mean to moralize here, but I see people posturing endlessly in public for approbation. They're looking for you know, likes and thumbs ups and, you know, yay, you did great, from people on the internet who are real people. That's great. But they're not the people that live anywhere nearby, right? I mean, the neighbors or, you know, the person down the street or, you know, I grew up just before all this stuff was invented. And I count myself lucky in that regard. But I can see it in other people that it's their whole lives. They don't know another way. And I think we have to find, I'm not sure, maybe you, Peter. to make people feel the connections. We need the connections.
Yeah.
I feel like we're in it together while still maximizing
liberty. That's the devastating part of the, I believe, unscientific impositions of COVID-19. It really isn't. Folks out there, understand that. You need to find ways around it. You really need to find ways to be with people, to be loving, to hug. Don't let this destroy you, because what's happening to people, some of them are just getting really disturbed, and people are getting suicidal, they're getting depressed, they're getting anxious, and they feel unworthy of love in the extreme. And you need to find ways to engage the universe and to try to forward, I think, our liberty. That's what I'm working on. Well, let me tell you one thing, and then I need to finish this amazing, at times a little too deep for me, conversation. And that is, a few weeks ago, I got an idea that we old folks really needed to tell the young folks to go out and live and don't worry about us, we'll take care of ourselves. And I talked to one of my guests who was on was on this past Wednesday. I don't have any idea what date it is today. It's the 18th, so this would be the show that came on the 17th. Her name is Leah Wilson, and she has an organization called Stand for Health Freedom. And I did a declaration as the starting point, myself, 84, my wife, 69, and our mother, my mother-in-law, 94. And the declaration says that freedom comes first, your freedom, your love, your connection, get out there, live, go to school, get into business, work. Those of us 50 and older will take care of ourselves. We're the beginning of the increase and escalation, and we even put up a little chart to show people. So folks, do me and the world a favor and join already in 2 days, 5,000 people, I think, have signed up. And this will be sent automatically, this declaration, you don't have to do a thing, to your local assemblyman, congressional person, all the people in your state, and you'll see their names come up, who you're sending it to. It's all automatic. And when the Congress reconvenes, this machine will go back and send it also to your congressmen and senators. saying we want to open our world back up, for goodness sakes, and don't, because we're vulnerable, us older people, don't ruin your lives and the society and the economy. So I know that that's a bit of a stretch for Michael Fontaine, my dear friend. Thank you for the Stockdale. I could never imagine just how McCain did that, but that was my thought from the 70s, but it wasn't. It was this other guy. That's really good news. Folks, I hope that this kind of show just interests you rather than sort of churning you up. It turns me up a little bit. The ideas are deep and they're problematic, but let us love one another and let us stand up for freedom and liberty. Michael, thank you so much for being a friend, being on the show. You got a parting thought? We have about 30 seconds.
Parting thought. Well, thank you, Peter. I always enjoy talking to you. Our disagreements are at least as illuminating as our agreements, and I love thinking about all your ideas. I would like to urge your readers to give the paper a look. That'll be on your website that we're talking about. And everybody, as you said, we should try and think, how can we create a more loving world? And be unafraid to use the word, and just sort of embrace the concept and realize some people, as you say, they really need it. We have got to show people that every one of us is worthy of love. That's what it means to be a human being. So it's important stuff.
That's wonderful. Your picture momentarily froze with your hands up in a wonderful way. It's a great ending. I'm going to say it. God bless all of you. Love each other, stand up for liberty, and keep coming back here because we need each other and I need you to communicate with. Goodbye now from the Dr. Peter Bregenhauer.